Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good afternoon and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, scientific media editor of Cure Talks, joining you from India. This is Cure Talks, a 96th episode, and we are talking about role of HIFU in prostate cancer treatment and the recent FDA approval of the same. Our prostate cancer talks are conducted in association with Prostate Cancer International and the Prostate Cancer Foundation. After more than 10 years of clinical trials, the Food and Drug Administration on October the 9th approved the first high-intensity focused ultrasound device for ablation of prostate tissue. HIFU has already been approved for use in prostate tissue outside the U.S., and more than 50,000 men globally have been treated with focused ultrasound for prostate cancer. The option of a minimally invasive procedure that can selectively target and treat diseased tissue is very appealing for prostate cancer patients. We are talking to Dr. Stephen Ciante of Sarasota Prostate Cancer Center on HIFU, its implementation here in America, and how HIFU can help prostate cancer patients. Dr. Ciante is a board-certified urologist and is globally recognized for his advanced prostate cancer diagnostic methods. He has pioneered advances in HIFU treatment and is the founder and director of the Ciante Prostate Center in Sarasota, Florida. Welcome to Cure Talk, Dr. Ciante. It's a pleasure to have you here. My co-host for the show is Mike Scott. Mike is co-founder and president of Prostate Cancer International, a prostate cancer-specific, a not-for-profit educational and informational organization based in Virginia. Mike works for Calcium and is also a member of the board of directors of the National Organization for Rare Diseases and the International Myeloma Foundation. Hi, Mike.
Hope you're doing great.
Supporting Mike on the panel are prostate cancer advocates and survivors, Alan Edel, Tony Crispino, and Jim Bickstrom. Welcome, and it's great to have you all guys here. Before I hand over to Mike, I would like to thank our audience for sending in such great questions, which we will be addressing towards the end of the discussion. If you would like to ask a question live, you can please press a 1 on your keypad to let us know, and we will bring you on air to ask them. Mike, it's over to you.
Thank you, Priya. Good evening, Dr. Ciante. How are you?
Mike, nice to speak with you. I'm doing fine here in Sarasota.
Good. So, obviously, a number of people are very excited to have a new option for the treatment of prostate cancer, and I'm sure some of the manufacturers of the equipment are even more excited. I would appreciate it if you could take a little time to sort of talk us through where you think we are today in the potential use of this new technique in America. I think there are a number of things that would be nice if you could address. Some of us are a little concerned by the lack of any published data on outcomes over time, and I don't mean that in a nasty way. I'm just saying that. I think also, given the nature of the approval by the FDA, there may be some confusion about the sort of breadth of use of HIFU in the management of prostate cancer, because the actual indication is, to say the least, a little vague. And so any light you think you can shed on how you expect to be using HIFU and other people like you who do have experience, I think it would be interesting for us to hear about. So over to you.
Okay. Well, thanks, Mike. First of all, I'm a prostate cancer clinician, and so my practice is really focused on minimally invasive ablative treatment for prostate cancer. Ablation, and I'm sure I don't want to be redundant, I'm sure the audience probably knows what ablation is because of relatively sophisticated group of folks on the call, but ablation really is the direction of energy into the prostate, and that goes back to, you know, using things like cryoablation going back even 20 years ago. But interestingly, if we look at where HIFU has gone, globally, that technology has been under development over the last 20 some odd years. And the first HIFU treatments were done using the EDAP device in France as early as 1995 for prostate cancer. And as you, as has been said, it, many treatments have been done, you know, certainly in Europe and in the Asian area. In the United States, there's been very limited use, obviously, except for two very small clinical trials that were under the auspices of the FDA, which were both sponsored by the manufacturers. Okay, now I had the opportunity with the salvage trial to be one of the lead proctors, overseeing a lot of the training at some of the clinical trial sites during that. And that was, in the Sonoblate case, a clinical trial that was done for the treatment of radiation recurrent prostate cancer. It was a relatively small number of patients treating the very difficult clinical problem of radiation recurrence. In the EDAP trial, that was a primary trial that was designed to compare low-risk prostate cancer treatment to cryotherapy. And interestingly, they never could enroll the cryotherapy arm. And today it's pretty clear that we would never consider using cryotherapy in low-risk prostate cancer. And you remember that both of these trials were designed many, many years ago, before our thinking on prostate cancer changed. But those trials were essentially trials that couldn't really be fully enrolled, and really, when they came to the FDA advisory panel meeting about a year or so ago, about October of 2014, in the case of the EDAP trial, they were all low-risk patients, and the panel basically said they're all low-risk patients. We probably shouldn't be treating some of these men, and how do we interpret this data? And in the case of the Sonoblate trial, about a third of the patients were low-risk recurrent patients, and they had the same concerns. Realize that in the salvage population, there were a lot of side effects in that trial, as would be expected treating radiation recurrent patients with any modality. So what that led to, and it's important to understand the process, the FDA had a change in their methodology that opened up something called a 510K de novo pathway for new devices. And it wasn't specific to HIFU, but HIFU would fit into this in the United States. And what the agency was allowed to do because of a rules change was to look at published prospective trials from outside of the United States. So they looked at data that came out of Britain, out of Japan, data that came out of France, Germany, and as long as the data could be verified, going back to what are called case reports, initial case report forms, then the FDA would accept that data in its decision-making process about whether or not the technology had any effect at all, was it effective, and was it safe. So that's the pathway. Using this 510K de novo pathway by which the Sonoblate device was able to obtain approval. So and the FDA stated...
If I may just ask,
yeah.
We're talking about data like the Ahmed and Edmonds data in the UK. I believe there's one person in Japan who's
Yoshida, yeah, the Yoshida.
Who produced a significant amount of data. Those
right,
are the
about
sort of
1,000
data
cases,
we're talking
yeah.
about, correct?
Right. And EDAP submitted Dr. Christian Chossi's data, as well as Gillet and Sebastian Cruzet's data. So there was both manufacturers relied on large databases maintained in some of those primary markets. It submitted those databases, which were gone back and verified by the FDA. Okay. Now, the FDA stayed away from specifically a cancer indication, and I don't know what the nature of the negotiation was, but what they examined the data for was, does the technology, does the treatment ablate prostate tissue? In other words, is there evidence that when you apply energy with HIFU to the prostate and you go back and subsequently re-biopsy that area, you obtain a negative biopsy of that area in a high percentage of patients. In other words, do you effectively ablate the target tissue? Okay, and so that's not the question of whether one cures prostate cancer. It's a question of whether one can ablate tissue. And therefore, the FDA's indication specifically says for prostate tissue ablation, and they make no claims at all or labeling regarding cancer specifically. And so as to how it's used in the United States and what one can say about the use of prostate cancer, a manufacturer, whether it be Sonicare, who makes the Sonoplate device, or whether it be EDAP, who makes the Ablifer device, neither manufacturer will be able to make advertisements or claims regarding the treatment of their device specifically for prostate cancer. They can talk about prostate ablation. Now, clinicians, physicians, can use the technology, however, in their best medical judgment, they think fit to treat whatever that particular condition. So one could theoretically treat benign prostate enlargement. One can treat high-grade PIN lesions. One could treat atypical precancerous or atypical small SNR proliferations or ASAPs, or one could treat prostate cancer. Now, as to how it's going to be used in the United States, I don't think we'll see any significant use for benign prostate enlargement because it's much easier ways to treat the disease. And I also can't imagine that, you know, we'll use it very much to treat high-grade PIN lesions because we're going to observe those in almost every case. We'll observe those in every case anyway. So I think you will see a lot of the use of the device for prostate cancer, which is within the FDA guidelines of ablation. But it's clear to understand that the FDA guideline does not address prostate cancer, and the FDA makes no claims about its success rate in treating prostate cancer. That is something that, you know, with the clinicians and with the aggregation of clinical outcomes, those statements will be able to be made in the future, at least from U.S. data. But it's not there right now. One can't make the cancer claims specifically.
Perhaps we could ask, is there any intent on the part of a small number of you who have what I would describe as extensive experience of carrying out HIFU, who are now going to be bringing that skill into the United States? Based on some of the data I have seen, there is a clear indication that it takes a while to learn how to do this really well, and probably as with surgery and everything else like this, there are some people who will just be more talented than others and will be able to do it better.
That's true.
I'm curious whether the opinion leaders among you are going to try to develop some form of registry system to track data over time, and how you are thinking about, with the manufacturers, how you are thinking about the appropriate training and maybe not certification, but at least, you know, mentoring of those who want to learn how to do this well, because potentially there are significant risks for patients here.
Oh, listen, you are absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct, and those are major challenges, and I think it's a major challenge to any new technology. So let me tell you, this is, again, I'm going to give you some of my opinion. You're quite correct that American urologists will try and jump into this very quickly, and some may have gone to a weekend course. Some may have done one or two procedures over the last 10 years at international locations. And there'll be a handful of people, a relative handful of people, that have got a significant clinical experience. In other words, they're comfortable with the technology, in terms of how to carry out the treatment. What I will say is that what happens in the treatment room is only half the part of getting a successful outcome. Proper patient selection is really critically important. Not every patient's a candidate, number one. So understanding where HIFU fits is an important part of training. Understanding how to deliver the treatment is an important aspect. and then how to care for that patient post-training and post-treatment, and then how to monitor that patient are important aspects. And those will be the challenges. So the manufacturers can't legislate what the physicians do. I think they don't have the ability to tell someone in a, who happens to get their access to a device in some remote area they can't treat a patient. What it's incumbent upon urologists to do and professional societies to do, I think, is to require really training and credentialing. So you're starting to see this occur. So one of the systems that I'm becoming involved with is a company that's now forming. It's called Vituro Health, and we're negotiating right now my role as their medical director. And some of the things that I've said are critically important in order for me to do that is that we need to create a registry. Because that's something we've never been able to do. There's never been the financing. The manufacturer wouldn't support it before. But now, with cases going on in the United States, there is a requirement to track the data not in a hodgepodge way, but in a very formal way in which every data point's being recorded. And that can be done if you've got physicians as part of, a program where they're, as a condition for them using the device, they've got to agree to participate in the registry. So that's one thing that's going to happen.
Would you be planning to do that with some sort of external oversight, in association with one of the major prostate cancer centers at a university or something?
Well, whether it's with a university or whether it's with EndoCare, the cryotherapy manufacturers did with an external sort of monitoring database, one of the two I think is important. But you got to track outcomes.
Right.
Number one. Number two, I think very important. You've got to assure that the physicians that are doing the procedure as part of one's organization have been properly trained with proper proctoring, QA, proper patient selection, and proper support. And that really is very important, because if you have poor patient selection, then patients who aren't the ones who would optimally benefit get treated, and that doesn't help the patient. And it certainly won't help the technology in the United States. So I think it's something that has to be done in a very organized way, but only be done if physicians are part of a larger organization. So there's two or three organizations like this beginning right now in the U.S., and I think all are thinking the exact same thing. Realize we're only about 3 or 4 weeks post-approval, so a lot of this is under construction as we speak.
Sure.
For example, in our center in Sarasota, we'll begin treatments the first week in December. Initially, I will be involved neither performing or overseeing every single treatment that occurs in the center. So I'll review every case. I'll be personally involved with overseeing every case. And until a physician is done at least 6 cases with proper oversight, they won't be allowed to work independently. So that is the sort of attention that's got to be placed in order to get good outcomes. Now, the risk is, and Mike, I think you've hit the nail right on the head here. The risk is that there will be people who will get their companies will get their hands on technology, and they'll move them around the United States to different centers without a whole lot of concern about quality or about proper outcomes. And I think that's a terrible mistake. So I think it's our patients out there have got to be savvy enough to ask questions of their physicians. Hey, what's your experience level? How comfortable are you? How many of these have you done? And what's your backup? Who are you working with to help you? Getting proper training. How have you been trained? Who have you trained with? Unfortunately, right now in the U.S., there's not a lot of experience sitting at our universities. For example, when I was at NYU for a couple of years full time, and we were involved in the salvage trial in which we were only allowed to, each site could do no more than about 8 cases. because they wanted them spread out. So there's no real high concentration of experience at any of the universities in the United States at this point. And so I think you'll see a lot of this evolve, but it's not there right now. So those will be the challenges. But it's something that I'm certainly well aware of, that there's a need for it.
So I think you've given us a very nice introduction. I appreciate that. Thank you. One of the things that obviously is going to be an issue is coverage for this treatment. And I'm curious if you have been, if you can share with us any information about issues about that, in the sense that, you know, obviously there are different types of use of the technology that one would consider to be potentially really valuable. I mean, in other words, even though the outcomes after salvage HIFU, after radiation, were not world-shatteringly wonderful, it is clearly better than a lot of the other options.
That's correct.
And so, you know, and the other question is coverage going to be available for a repeat HIFU if a patient needs that? That would be one of the things I'm interested in. The other one is the whole question of the conversation with a patient who is a good candidate for active surveillance.
That's a great point.
If you might be a good idea.
No, that's a great point. So let's take the insurance coverage, then we'll go back to the surveillance. At this point in time, there are no commitments from any insurers in the United States at this point in time to cover the procedure. Okay. Now, that will change, but it's going to take time. And the only way that is going to occur is by presenting one insurer at a time with an understanding of the technology, but they're going to want to see, and this is why a U.S.-based database registry will be important. The insurers want to see outcomes as well. So this is going to take some time until we see insurance approvals or payment across the board. I would estimate, this is a guess, I would estimate it might take 4 or 5 years, but on a case-by-case basis, I think we will be able to see individual patients get coverage on a case-by-case appeal basis, making a case-by-case appeal for patients. And so working direct with the insurance companies is something that's going to be very important to do, and the manufacturers are going to have to really take a major role in that as well, because they're obviously going to have a lot more procedures with their technology if there's a reimbursed insurance code. Now, as to retreatments, it's anyone's guess as to how that's going to be covered. Right now, one of the manufacturers treating in the Caribbean market, Sonicare, had a policy in place that they would treat patients who needed a second treatment at a reduced price. But those international sites are closing as we speak, because most patients in the U.S. don't want to go to the Bahamas or don't want to go to Mexico. And so the demand, I think, will go away very quickly for international sites. And with that, we're going to have to really address, reimbursement issues for people who need second treatments. HIFU, like every other treatment that we do, including radical surgery, has a biochemical and a pathologic recurrence rate, without question. And the higher the Gleason grade, the higher the recurrence rate is, and that's true of every treatment. So we are going to have the need for patients that require salvage therapy. And sometimes HIFU is an appropriate salvage therapy, sometimes it's not. But that getting those insurance issues reimbursed will be one of the first priorities, I think, in the U.S., but it will initially be on a case-by-case basis. And what I'm telling my patients right now is they really can't expect insurance reimbursement at this point in time, and don't go down this path with the hope that they'll talk the insurance company into it, because we just don't know that that would happen. Now, active surveillance, that's an intriguing question, because in my mind, active surveillance patients are active surveillance patients. And so no treatment, no matter how non-invasive, really should be a substitute for active surveillance, because there is no treatment that's got zero side effects. It doesn't exist. So if a patient truly has low volume, low-grade, low-risk disease, and we can talk about by which parameters, but truly clinically insignificant disease, that patient then becomes, in my mind, an excellent candidate for surveillance. And that's not the patient that needs any treatment at all. So just because HIFU has or may be less invasive than surgery doesn't mean we ought to treat insignificant disease, because a treatment is still a treatment. Okay, that's my philosophy.
Would you consider that to be true? I mean, there's a small number of patients for whom the whole concept of living with a cancer in their prostate is a very traumatic experience.
Right. No. So again, you've got to look at this on a case by case basis, right? And so what I'm trying to say is that we shouldn't use a minimally invasive treatment across the board for low risk patients, because with the idea that we should at least do something for them. But you're correct. I see patients in the office every day who really it's their choice to not live with the disease, but yet they wouldn't accept a radical prostatectomy, for example. So I think that becomes an option for them. But this is a discussion that the doctor must have with his patient. You know, it's about defining their disease. It's about understanding the true extent of their disease. It's about characterizing the disease and laying out then for that patient what the risk of options are, ranging from active surveillance all the way to, different forms of treatment. There's no question that patients who have surveillance, capable disease have radical prostatectomies. That happens for sure, because the patient decides they don't want to watch that disease. But I think it's about having that one-on-one, very detailed, and very personalized discussion with that gentleman and talking about what their options really are and taking into consideration the characteristics of the disease, their age, and of course in prostate cancer, patient preferences still play a major role in the direction that one takes.
So I have one more slightly off-the-wall question for you, and then I'm going to ask some of the other panelists to participate. So my off-the-wall question is, we know that a small number of patients with severe, chronic, recurrent prostatitis, and I'm talking about really severe, have been successfully treated with radical prostatectomies. Have you ever treated such a patient with HIFU?
Honestly, no, I haven't. We've really limited the treatment in the international locations to men with histologic prostate cancer. So I think that's new territory. And frankly, I honestly don't know how they would respond. And here's the problem, is that many times severe chronic prostatitis, the chronic pain associated with that syndrome oftentimes will persist even when you've treated the prostate. And so I think that's something that's going to require – that's something that really is going to require a formal research study. So that sort of thing, because I think it's really unknown as to the outcome and where ablation fits, that would be something that I think would have to be studied pretty rigorously in order to answer that question. Potentially, it could be helpful, but I really don't know at this point.
Okay. So we have three panelists with us today. Alan Edel, who has a great deal more experience of management of patients with radiotherapy than I do. Tony Crispino, who is the SWOG patient representative on the SWOG GU panel. And Jim Wickstrom, who there's some rumor that you may have treated him. So
I think I know Jim.
So maybe Alan, are you there?
Yes.
Perhaps you would
like to
see if you have a couple of questions for Dr. Cianti.
Sure. One question I have is about that Ushida study you mentioned. They reported 5-year biochemical recurrence-free survival of 48% for the Sonoblade 200 model, and then over time it came up to 82% for the Sonoblade 500 TM model. And I was wondering, is that due to technological advances And if so, what were they? Because that's an astounding improvement. Or is it a practitioner expertise just coming along the learning curve? And what further advances would you like to see in the technology in the future?
That's an excellent question. Okay, so to answer your question, I think there's been major technological advances. There's no way we can discount the fact that the practitioner got better. So there's a bit of both going on there. But the major advances, the Sonoblade 200 was a very primitive device that can only treat the prostate, and I don't want to get too technical here, but it treated in a 60-degree sector window, which means that you had to, you know, you had to treat the standard prostate instead of three zones in at least six, if not eight zones. Now, what that did is it left a lot of possibilities for missing tissue. If you didn't have complete overlap, there was tissue that wasn't treated. We know that once we start to deliver energy to the prostate's going to swell. It's going to change size. So when we design a HIFU treatment, we're capturing a series of ultrasound images, and then we're designing a treatment to cover a series of captured images. Now, the minute you turn the machine on and start to treat somebody, the prostate changes size and shape. So it's a very dynamic process, but you're using a treatment plan that you designed at some point earlier in the procedure. And so if the prostate is changing size and shape, what was happening in those early days is the energy was going to a target that was old. In other words, the target changed and you didn't recognize it. So one of the first major advances made technically with the Sonoblate was that it had what's called a restacking feature. It had the ability to, after 5 to 7 minutes of treatment or so, or at numerous intervals, to take a brand new series of images and realign the treatment with the new images and then adjust the treatment to the changing target. Adjust the treatment to the changing target. Very important, because now you can continue to conform the energy to the changing target. That was one of the major advances as you went from the Sonoblate 200 to the Sonoblate 500. A second and very important change was the ability to incorporate what's called tissue change monitoring, or TCM. That's a TCM version. So as ultrasound energy goes from the transducer up into the prostate, there is some absorption and attenuation of energy on the way to the focal zone or to the target. Okay, and so as that occurs, there is really was no way to assure there is the proper deposition or absorption of energy in the target zone as opposed to it being absorbed in the pre-target zone or in the area where between the target and the rectal wall. And so tissue change monitoring is a mechanism by which the software is able to measure the physical characteristics of the tissue on ultrasound before and after the treatment pulse and document the degree to which the characteristics changed. Okay. Now, that has been documented in vivo in a study that was done by Dr. Marburger, in which they were able to correlate actual temperature changes in the focal zone with the measured TCM changes. So, from a practical standpoint, as one is doing the treatment with TCM, one delivers treatment to an area, and in real time, on the fly, as we treat, we're getting a direct readout from the software about whether each little volume of tissue we treat is getting the appropriate energy and whether it's changing. If it doesn't, we can go back and on the fly retreat that zone. So when we leave the procedure room, we have a better assurance that the area that's been targeted has absorbed enough energy to cause a treatment change. That's been very important. One of the other changes that happened physically in the device is the size of the treatment lesion also increased between the Sonoblate 200 and 400. And now we had available, for example, the ability to make a 12 by 12 by 3 lesion. And what that did technically, it allowed us to treat little larger prostates with more overlap between the zones. So those three advances, you know, going to a stacking mode, going to larger lesions, going to tissue change monitoring, were major technical advances. Now, those were in place even several years ago because Yoshida's reported on outcomes using TCM, and TCM was introduced, and he first began to use it somewhere around 2011 or so, 2010, 2011. As for the future, I think anyone who knows some of the work I do, I'm a major advocate of using MRI to define the disease as well as to help design treatment. So one of the major advances we're seeing now is the integration of MRI fusion into the treatment platform. So in other words, we can use MRI to tell us several things. We can help us to understand prostate anatomy better. We can help us to understand the location of the neurovascular bundles. And we can help us to identify, you know, the locations of the most significant tumor location in the prostate. That information then can be superimposed onto the ultrasound images to help in treatment planning. And I think that's a major advance. So that is the future for that really exists now because that technology has been integrated into both manufacturers' platforms. The Sonoblade platform has it and will have it in the United States. And the EDAP platform, they call their platform the Focused One that has MRI integration, is available in Europe. And it's my understanding that EDAP will plan to make that available soon in the United States as well.
Okay, I want to make sure we have plenty of time for questions from the patients that are on the line other than the panel. So, Tony, do you have one question for Dr. Scionti?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Dr. Scionti, for a very comprehensive explanation. It's very helpful. The question I come on over, being somebody that works from the clinical trial background, is informed consent forms. If we go ahead and address them in clinical trial setting, I hear your explanation that while the procedure is approved in the U.S., there's only so much claim about what you can say you're doing. How is this addressed directly with the patient, and how do you explain to them that while you can't say cancer-specific, perhaps what you can say at this particular point is not, but maybe your input on exactly what you can tell that patient is very helpful.
Well, no, I think that's a great point, and that's why I tried to make that point earlier and try to, you know, work through what the FDA, language was. I think it's very important. At this point, having a conversation with a patient, and again, it's all about being full disclosure here, to say that we have proof that we can cure your prostate cancer, that can't be that's not substantiated, okay? As an ablation specialist, I talk about ablating disease, ablating regions of abnormal tissue, ablating tumor. That's short of claiming cures. So I think patients have to understand what ablative therapies can do and what they can't do, okay? So if we can take a targeted area and turn it biopsy negative, does that prove that there won't be a recurrence? No. Does that prove that there can't be distant recurrence? No. And I think those kind of conversations have to be had. So I think it really comes down to the conversation. Now, what will we see in the United States? We're going to see all kinds of things said to patients. There's no question about that. That subtle distinction, and maybe for us, for those of us on the call, it's not terribly subtle, but for a lot of physicians, they won't get that distinction between ablation and true cancer treatment. So I think you will see a lot of what you're referring to and what you're probably concerned about. I think you'll see some of that going on in the U.S. I think those of us that are in a position of medical directorship and leadership are very clear about the language we use and what we tell patients.
And Jim, do you have a question for Dr. Scionti?
Well, good question. He's actually answered my questions very well. I would just like to say that I kind of backdoored prostate cancer by having a physician stand over me and tell me he's got an appointment on Friday if I wanted my surgery, which is a little challenging emotionally. And I did my due diligence by interviewing dozens of patients. And that's where I learned everything. And, boy, you hear a whole lot of the patient groups and their complaints and their feelings that are very personal, because losing, for a man to lose his ability to urinate, control the urination or impotence, is just challenging. And as Dr. Ciante pointed out, you've got to do one-on-one work with people. And so many physicians are not trained to do this. They move on to the next patient, as we all know. And since the urology community is in conflict with itself in so many ways, having this less invasive treatment of HIFU available is so powerful. So that's all I wanted to say.
So, Dr. Ciante, I have one last question for you before we I give this back to Priya for her to bring in the other people on the line. That relates to the use of HIFU in focal therapy. I assume you have some experience of at least trying this. And I'm curious, you know, whether you think that this is a really serious opportunity to expand the potential for focal therapy.
The answer is yes, and I'll elaborate just for a moment. Again, I don't want to steal everybody's time here. I'm very much you've had Professor Emberton on here as a guest on this forum, and I'm one of his disciples, you might say. Okay. I've worked with Mark on numerous committees. We've been on faculty on a lot of courses that we've taught together. And I believe in properly selected patients, and this is the key, that focal therapy is a real opportunity. Now, the challenge of focal therapy is diagnostics. If one tries to select patients for focal therapy based on a systematic 10 or 12 core ultrasound-guided biopsy, it will fail, because that diagnostic technique is not capable of selecting out patients who truly have focal disease. There's no question that there are patients with an index lesion and clinically insignificant disease or absent disease elsewhere in the prostate, but you've got to work hard to find those with advanced diagnostics. And in much like the Hash Ahmed and Mark Emberton, in our center, we really advocate 3T MRI, systematic and fusion biopsy, and really a careful selection of men who are candidates for focal. But yes, in those patients, there's no question that on the side effect side, there's a marked decrease in side effects. What we don't know long term is how many of those patients will develop disease in the preserved part of the prostate, and that's the question. I'm very confident in the ability to destroy an index lesion. We know that we can do that in excess of 90% of the time by biopsy documentation. What we don't know is the preserved tissue. What chance does that preserved tissue have of developing significant prostate cancer over 5 years, 10 years, 15 years? That question's unanswered. That's the controversy about focal therapy. And I think you've heard that discussion, I think, in this debate many times. But I think it's an opportunity if done with careful diagnostics.
Okay, well, I think you've been very forthcoming and very, very frank with us, which has been very nice. So that's great. And Priya, I'm going to throw this back to you now for questions from the audience on the phone.
Thank you, Mike. That has been a very eye-opening discussion, I think. We have a list of questions, Dr. Ciante, sent in by our listeners. Some of them are just coming in. We will just quickly go through them. We have about 15 minutes to address these. We have a couple of questions asking about the side effects and recurrence rates of HIFU. So maybe you could take a few minutes to explain that.
Okay, that's really central to our discussion. I think the first thing to understand is that with recurrent rates, and recurrence rates are proportional to the grade and stage of disease across every single treatment. There's no question about that. So if people are making claims about any treatment and saying, if I've got a Gleason grade 7 stage T2B prostate cancer and I treat it with any technology, whether it be surgery, radiation, or HIFU, and I get a 98% biochemical recurrence-free rate, that's just incorrect. That's not going to happen with any modality today. So I think that what I tell patients is that, you know, once we understand graded and staging, we can give them an estimate of where recurrence rates are in published data. And I think some of the data, especially out of the longer-term work from Yoshida, from Crusay, from Chaucer, really suggests those biochemical disease recurrence rates are pretty favorable. Now, are they? Has anyone ever done a prospective head-to-head comparison? No. And so it's very dangerous to make statements about HIFU being superior to anything in terms of recurrence rates. You cannot say that. Now, side effects are related to two things: how much of the gland do you have to treat? It's related to where you put energy. It's also related to experience. If one targets the rectal wall with this technology, there's a risk for rectal injury. Having said that, proper training should avoid that, and that should become a very rare event with proper training. So side effects really depend on practitioner experience. They also depend on the grade and severity of the disease. If one's trying to treat bulky extraprostatic disease, there will be more side effects. There's no question.
And what sort of rate of good erectile function would you expect to get in, say, you know, a common old garden T7, T2B case today?
Yeah, no, good question. I think that depends on whether or not you can spare the neurovascular bundles. And to making that decision, I use MRI extensively. So you'll see in the radical prostatectomy community, a lot of surgeons beginning to use MRI to make those decisions. I believe MRI is helpful for HIFU to make those decisions as well. So if the tumor is bulging the capsule near the neurovascular bundle, I don't think you can preserve that bundle with any treatment at all. So to tell a patient with a T2B lesion that the lesion is infringing upon the neurovascular bundle, to promise that patient potency is incorrect, because if you do that, you're going to spare tumor. Now, the converse is, if the tumor really is well demarcated interior to the capsule, away from the bundle, the patient's a candidate for nerve sparing, and we treat the entire prostate, we can look at about 80% of those men having a functional erection by 3 to 6 months out. If one does a totally focal procedure, a minimal procedure, treats one or two centimeter lesion well away from the bundles, that patient can expect better than a 90% return to potency very quickly. But it depends on the disease, it depends on the location, and I think this is where the diagnostics are really important in terms of giving patients proper advice.
Thank you. Priya?
Thank you, Mike. Dr. Cianti, John writes in from the UK. He says, I'm in the UK where HIFU is approved on the NHS. For low-volume, low-risk Gleason 6 men like me, is this treatment the best currently available and with minimal side effects?
Okay, so John, the real question is how old are you, and are you a candidate for active surveillance? And is active surveillance, you can't have fewer side effects than active surveillance. But understand that there's a lot of psychological load that goes with active surveillance. So, yes, I mean, may you be an excellent candidate for HIFU? Yes. Prostate size is critically important. If you've got a small lesion, a small prostate, you may be an excellent candidate. If you've got a small tumor and a very large prostate, you'd be a very poor HIFU candidate. So it really goes down to an understanding about the load of disease, the location of disease, the volume of disease. And I think the UK has really taken the lead. A lot of the folks have taken the lead with MRI imaging. And so, I think looking at some of the work done at the University College of London by Mark Emerton and his colleagues, I'd encourage you to look, because if you've got Gleason 6 disease and it's a large enough tumor and it's well seen, you may be a candidate for a focal ablation. So, I think going back to a personalized approach is very important.
Thank you, Doctor. The next question is from Mike, who asks, can results for HIFU treatment be expected to be similar for areas outside the prostate, like seminal vesicles, lymph nodes, bladder, neck, as normal treatment to the prostate bed?
The short answer to that is no. HIFU is an ablative treatment, is best used for very localized disease. If the advantage to HIFU is low side effects, treating men with advanced disease, especially in neighboring structures, is going to produce a lot more side effects. So in my practice, if I see a patient that's suspected of having extensive seminal vesicle involvement or tumor encroaching on the bladder neck or certainly any risk of lymph node involvement, I'm generally referring to those patients to my radiation therapy colleagues. We're not treating those patients with HIFU. So, again, it's really not designed for extensive disease. Now, interestingly, Christian Chossi has published some work out of Germany looking at a series of patients with bulky advanced disease and looked at that as a disease palliation mode and reports that they've done fairly well. But that's certainly not where we think about HIFU classically, and I don't think it's where we ought to see it used in the United States.
Thank you, Doctor. The next question is, EDAP's Ablatherm was also FDA-approved on November 9th. They have a fully robotic model with MRI imaging focal one that is also expected to be 510K cleared. Could you please comment on this?
Yeah, we talked about that a little while ago. I think it's an excellent platform. The Ablatherm platform has been extremely well studied. The Focal One has got MRI integration. They will get a 510K on that, and I think it's really going to be more of the experience of the surgeon than it will be of which particular machine they use. Both machines are capable of getting excellent outcomes. I think it really comes down to proper patient selection, proper execution of the treatment by an experienced surgeon, and proper care of that patient post-op. But I'm excited to see their technology in the United States, because I think that surgeons need to have a choice and use which platform they feel is going to suit their needs the best. But yeah, I think that's very important that we have both of these available.
Thank you, Doctor. There's a caller online. Person calling in from 206-240-0133. You're on air. Please ask your question.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, good. Well, this is Mike from Seattle. Doctor, I've talked to you before about 6 weeks ago, and you answered one of the questions I had about seminal vesicle treatment with this new machine. In my case, that's what I'm going to have to do, a bilateral treatment, both the right and left. And I wondered if you've actually had done that when you were in, the Grand Cayman and Bahamas experience. Or I think, like I say, you just answered that, but have you ever actually done that?
Okay, so done a complete gland treatment or treating well into the seminal vesicles?
Just the seminal vesicles, the biopsies and the C11 choline. Just a refresher, we're okay on the prostate bed, confirmed by biopsy that there's nothing there.
Yeah, so again, you look at the optimal patient for HIFU, it's the localized disease patient, right? But if we've got an isolated lesion that we know and it's just into a seminal vesicle area and we can see the area, there's no reason we can't put energy there. The problem is, and the risk is that once we see seminal vesicle disease, and this is true of any treatment, any localized treatment, even though our studies for metastatic disease are negative, there is a very significant risk, at least microscopically, of disease that's been disseminated throughout the bloodstream or disseminated into the lymph nodes or the bone scan, and it's not being picked up by these assays. So the short answer is, if we see an isolated lesion, even if it's in the seminal vesicle, we can target it. the uncertainty is, as good as the studies are for metastatic disease, the studies don't totally exclude metastatic disease. And if there is disease that's distant and not being detected, then treating a seminal vesicle lesion, for example, won't be curative at all because the disease elsewhere. And that really is because we don't have, even given some of the assays you mentioned, we still don't have a totally sensitive test for microscopic disease that's well outside of the prostate. It still doesn't exist today, and that's the challenge.
Okay.
Thank you, Doctor. There's another caller online. Caller using 703-425-5141. Please ask your question.
Okay.
Thank you, Doctor. There's another caller online.
Hello.
Caller using 703. Please ask your question.
Hey, hello, Dr. Scanty. Thanks for a very informative talk. I would like to know, are you tracking your own results systematically, as in all consecutive patients? If so, would you care to share your results, or do you expect to be able to announce your results at some time?
Okay, so, over the last 10 years, patients have been treated in 8 different foreign countries, literally from all over the world, without a university research team behind me, much as exists in the UK, for example, or with in Japan with Dr. Yoshida. So do I have some results? Yes. Are they robust to the point where there's no missing data points? No, that's just been impossible to do. So going forward with the introduction in the United States and formal protocols, formal companies behind this, that will be much more feasible to do. Okay. Now, what I do have and what we're working on pulling together is I have a subset of patients that have been well-tracked who have focal treatments. In focal treatment, I'm very insistent, and anyone that's seen me for a focal treatment has heard me say this, is that we're going to follow patients very carefully, and I'm going to insist on MRI follow-up and a biopsy at the one-year mark to document the complete ablation of the tumor, as well as to look at the rest of the prostate to be sure there's not been a development of tumor in the remaining healthy tissue. That's a fairly robust series that we're actually trying to put together right now. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that now that treatment's centralized in one location that people are, that are much more organized in that manner. But as you can imagine, with people treated at 8 different centers over 10 years, that's been very difficult to do.
And Dr. Scionti, how many patients are in that focal therapy series, roughly?
Roughly right now, with good data, we've got about 90 patients.
And how long is the series? In other words,
The first patient was treated about 4 years ago.
Okay, thank you. So I have one more question before we end the call, and that is, this is now the third. We've now have two types of HIFU approved. One of which is the Insightec equipment that was originally approved for the treatment of metastatic pain. Do you expect to see HIFU being used more in the palliative area in due course, in the sense that it can probably be targeted in ways to treat isolated lesions?
The potential's there.
Radiation can't be used.
The potential's certainly there. The potential's most definitely there for example, for bone tumors and bone pain. Any area that one can target is potentially there. So I think now that we have technology available in the United States, I think you are going to see, under clinical trial protocols, I think you are going to see that studied. And that certainly is an area for expanded use, and where I think it could be of benefit. But I think that has to really be studied in an organized manner. And now that there are platforms that will be available, they'll be at universities, they'll be at centers where this work can be done. I think you will see that being used outside of the urology department.
Well, thank you very much indeed for your time, Dr. Scionti. I'm going to hand this back to Priya for us to sign off, but you've been very forthcoming this evening, and I think people have learned a lot about the opportunities that may exist in the near future and in the longer term as well. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the invitation to be on the show.
Dr. Scionti, it has been wonderful listening to you. The approval of HIFU is hopefully definitely going to be a turning point for treatment of prostate cancer in America. With that note, I'd like to wrap up today's Cure Talk. Thank you, Mike, Alan, Jim, and Tony. This talk is available on Cure Talk's website. Please visit curetalks.com for details on upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Dr. Scionti. Good night. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Good night, everyone.